This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 1st of January 2013 on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Moncler.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from St Moritz with me, Andrew Tuck, and Sophie Grove. Coming up in the next 60 minutes,
we'll talk to Marcus Hauser, who's been our host for the past week, to talk about the state of tourism this Christmas in St Moritz and the lessons it has for the rest of Europe.
Then we'll catch up with Claudio Bernasconi, owner of the Waldhaus am See Hotel here in St Moritz, to find out why he built the world's largest whiskey collection.
25 years ago, I was in India. I brushed my teeth with whiskey because the bacteria in the water was not so very good. So I take the whiskey and then I taste it and then I brush my teeth. And after 1 week, I say, oh, whiskey is very good. And so I start to collect whiskies.
We speak to world champion and Olympic sailor Enrico de Maria about what makes St Moritz match race one of the most special ones on the Alpari Tour.
And we will hear the last instalment of Sophie's spa guide to the area. This time, she meets the general manager of the venerable Hotel Kulm and strips off for a Swiss herbal deep tissue massage. We'll hear the verdict.
We have various wraps that are fantastic for soothing the muscles after a full day of skiing, or we have a sport massage for those people who like it a little bit, a stronger massage.
All this, plus an interview with the artist Not Vidal, here on Midori House, live from Switzerland.
Well, lots ahead on this hour, Sophie, but we feel a little bit abandoned, don't we? Because Tyler Brûlé has vanished.
He has. He's been such an amazingly sort of important part of this whole series, and he just flew to Bangkok.
Yeah, we waved him off on the train at 4 o'clock, and he's left us here. It's like the parents have left the kids to run the show.
We're slightly bereft, but we've got such a great show to look forward to that we feel like we might. He's here in spirit, actually. I think as soon as the glue vines come out, we'll realise that, you know, he hasn't completely sort of left us.
In an odd way, and I mean this nicely, he's also here in biscuit form as well, because he left us a giant tin of biscuits to enjoy in his absence. Well, there's certainly lots to come up here, and as we'll be talking to the artist Not Vital, there's Sophie's spa guide. But first, let's catch up on the latest headlines with Jonathan Wheatley.
The US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is still receiving treatment at a New York hospital today after suffering a blood clot in a vein behind her right ear. Her doctor said that she is expected to make a full recovery. Meanwhile, Vice President Joe Biden is meeting fellow Democrats in the US House of Representatives to discuss the fiscal cliff deal that he helped forge with Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell. The deal raised some taxes on the wealthy while making permanent low tax rates on the middle class. Not everyone was pleased with the agreement, including Iowan Democrat Tom Harkin.
There are some good parts of this, but I repeat, I am concerned about this constant drift, bit by bit, deal by deal, toward more deficits, less job creation, more unfairness, less economic justice, a society where the gap grows wider between the few who have much and the many who have too little. So, Mr. President, for these reasons, I must in conscience vote no on this bill.
Well, on the streets of New York City today, shoppers like Kat Sullivan and Grace Bonick said that they were also not happy about the last-minute deal.
All we've heard for the last many months is the fiscal cliff and the fact that they wait until after the fact to make a decision. It feels like their partisanship is more important than the taxpayers, which is very frustrating.
You have no respect for the government right now. You have no respect for the people that you elect, Democrats, Republicans, doesn't matter what you are. At this point, I don't know why people are not just up in arms about it. Everybody should be down in Washington because you voted for these people. And nothing's happening.
10 people have today been found guilty by an Ethiopian court of plotting attacks against political and economic targets in the Horn of Africa country with the help of Islamist militants from neighbouring Somalia. Prosecutors said Kenyan national Hassan Jasso was the leader of the group of Ethiopians and the mastermind of the planned attacks. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez is in a stable condition and spent New Year's Eve with his daughters, the cancer-stricken leader's son-in-law said, in an appeal for supporters to ignore rumours about his condition. Chavez has not been seen in public nor heard from in more than 3 weeks. At least 60 people have been killed and around 200 more injured in a stampede during New Year celebrations in the main city of the Ivory Coast, Abidjan. It's not clear what caused the stampede, which happened early today near a stadium where a fireworks display was being held. On a happier note, in his New Year's message today, Pope Benedict said he hoped 2013 would be a year of peace.
Today, New Year's Day, we celebrate the image of Mary, Mother of God. With affectionate trust, Our Lady believes the message revealed to her by the saint's word on board Jesus Christ, true God and true man. May her powerful intercession bring you a happy and prosperous new year.
And finally, the four most annoying words or phrases for last year have been revealed today. New York's annual Marist poll has listed "you know," "whatever," "like," and "just saying" as the most annoying expressions for 2012. And that's the latest news from Monocle 24.
Whatever, Jonathan. You know, anyway. I kind of like it. Anyway, it's 1906 here in St. Moritz, and you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. You're listening to Midori House live from St. Moritz here in the Swiss Alps with me, Andrew Tuck, and Sophie Grove.
Now, I should just say, there was a groupie clinging onto one of our speakers just now. She had to be wrestled off one of her by her boyfriend. But we're joined here at the top of the show by Marcus Hauser, who has been hosting us here in the Monocle 24 Pavilion all week. Thank you for joining us, Marcus.
Thanks that you had been here this week, and it was great.
Well, it's got very lively. Suddenly you're on the show. Can we just ask you, one of the most interesting things I think for any hotel at this point of year is you can take a bit of a barometer about how well the local economy is doing by the number of bookings and how well the hotel's done. We heard earlier from a couple of the guests that, you know, the last couple of years have seen a few ups and downs, but this year, is it a very positive year for you?
It's always difficult to foresee the development of the season, as the guests book quite short notice. The reservations come always shorter and shorter. The December now luckily ended with a big surprise. We had an excellent December. I think what I hear around my colleagues hoteliers, they were all happy. The mountain railways were quite surprised by the number of skiers they had on the mountain as well.
And just tell me, how important is the weather? You know, you say people book last minute, so, you know, obviously it's a little bit dependent, I guess, on how much snow falls. Are you worried in November? Are you looking at the paper every day, seeing what the weather forecast is? Is your livelihood a little bit dependent on how the clouds blow?
Now, these times are over, definitely. We are looking for temperatures in the freezing area, in minus temperatures. That's what we are looking for. 10 years ago and 15 years ago, that was still a very nervous tension that we get these snowflakes from heaven. But now in these times, we turn on the snow-making machines, and that's fine. And we start at the end of October. It was a cold period for 3-4 days, and we could produce quite a bit of snow. Luckily for the World Cup races and the beginning of December for the Ladies World Cup, we had the slope ready.
And I wondered, I mean, we've been staying here for a week and absolutely loving it, but Every morning at breakfast I hear people chatting about, you know, some people have been coming here for decades, you know, their family holidayed here, and they did. Do you have new markets that you're looking at, or are you really looking at that sort of historic generations, the people we breakfast with in the morning, essentially?
The guests, the tradition guests, the repeaters with the family's tradition coming for years and years to St. Moritz, still there in the five-star hotels. You have still the families and generations coming. We are looking, of course, always for new clientele, and the markets developing at the moment is Brazil, India, China, Russia. So we did quite well in these markets, probably, and that's some of the future markets.
And tell me, what's interesting is watching the dynamic of this hotel during the day. In the morning when we come down for breakfast, it's the skiers preparing to go off for the day. By lunchtime, it's already getting crowded with people coming back from the slopes. By this time in the evening, it's the après skiers, a younger crowd. You're managing a kind of quite a complicated business appealing to lots of different kind of demographics. How important is that for you, that you do bring in all these different groups to make your business successful?
Yeah, at the times my father was happy to get the afternoon crowd on the terrace for coffee and cake. That's where we started off. He tried to close the business off as soon as possible, and he could have a drink outside with his friends. I try to run the business from the morning to midday, afternoon and evening, with different kind of guests, offering different events or different kind of food and drinks. I try to make the best out of the center place where we were sitting at.
I wondered, we're going to talk later about three star and that concept of sort of stars are very difficult to sort of really nail down, but this is what you're doing here, and I wondered, what does three stars mean to you, and how do you sort of keep that consistency?
The three star has a certain definition through the Swiss Hotel Association. That's a position you have, but what you really are is the personality, the size of the hotel, the positioning of the hotel. The three stars gives a guest an idea where he lands. But after all, it's just an idea what he gets. Each hotel is and should be a little bit different than the other, and each hotel should find their clientele.
And Marcus, tell me, the other interesting thing is when traditionally these winter hotels, they were very, very busy at this time of year, and then their owners and their staff would vanish during the summer. They'd probably go to Thailand, where Thailand's gone, or they'd disappear somewhere, and they'd literally kind of shut up shop. What's the dynamic now for you of running this hotel? How many staff do you say to goodbye to in, say, March, and say, that's the end of it, we don't need you for another year? Or are you trying to run a much more year-round enterprise here?
Absolutely. We are in center town. We have a position where we could open the hotel, where we can keep open the hotel over 350 days a year. Now, we keep the staff, over 50 staff, over the year. So they do holidays, or some go, some come. We have over the year more or less the same turnover, summer and winter, and that's quite interesting. Of course, we have more winter turnover, but with less guests. It's still more income in winter, but it's a little change. Summer is getting more important, and winter is getting harder. This December was great, but let's see what the winter, if it keeps up, it's fine.
And I wanted to ask you about the sort of generational, sort of, you inherited this from your father, and there is something of a sort of legacy here. Do you think that that's a very Swiss model that we're seeing around? We've been sort of observing that around St. Moritz particularly. Do you think that your children will, take up the baton of the Hauser Hotel?
It was a big tradition in Switzerland to have hotels, to hand them over to new generations, to the next generation. I hope that my children will take over. I can see from here my son working at the bar. He's in hotel school, and hopefully he will take over. My grandfather did a great thing, and he came up for to play curling up here and met the right guys on the table on the coffee shop, and had the chance to buy the small house to build a little pension and to build to produce pastry and chocolates and serve coffee and my father was developing it, and I tried to bring it further. So it's going to be hard for my son to bring it even further, but certainly he finds new ideas and hope he come back. Well, and two daughters around too.
Good. Well, Marcus, we've certainly had a great time with you here on the terrace, so thank you first of all for hosting us here in Samar. It's been great, and I think we've already determined that we'll be back in the summer and certainly next winter. But thank you for joining us on the top of the show. There's lots more to come. We're going to be talking to Claudio Bernasconi, who's another hotelier from a little bit further down the lake, who has built up an extraordinary whiskey collection. And then we'll also be speaking to Enrico De Maria, who's a big sailor and a big force in sailing up here in St. Moritz. And then there's Sophie's spa package, where she promises to strip off, all in the name of finding the best spa in St. Moritz. But that's all to come in just a moment. But for now, you're listening to Midori House live from St. Moritz, and we're going to be back with the whiskey talk just after this.
Montclair, keeping the slopes stylish and warm since 1952.
On Monocle's Culture Show, we want to be like the fabled Hydra, one of the great monsters of Greek myth, but in a good way. Listen to one fascinating story and two more eagerly pop up to replace it. So it's only scary if you're frightened of the following sorts of things. Reports from all over the world on art, books, magazines, media, music, film, publishing, advertising, and photography. Or if you're terrified of beautifully performed, intimate live music sessions from some of our favourite acts recorded in our performance space right here at Midori House. It's Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. It premieres on Mondays at 1900 London time, and frankly, it's the heroic Hercules that defeats the evil Hydra of radio boredom. Join us and enjoy the legend.
Welcome back to the latest edition of Midori House in St. Moritz. Indeed, our final show from up here in the Engadine Valley.
Now, Marcus Hauser is not the only hotelier thriving here in St. Moritz. Just along the lake is the Waldhaus am See Hotel, which has some of the most stunning views of the town and the mountains, and is a prime spot tonight for people watching the firework display that will start at 2200 hours.
A little earlier, Andrew dropped in on the owner, Claudio Bernasconi, who explained why Swiss visitors go for three-star hotels, how he built up the world's largest collection of whiskey, and why the secret of his success has been keeping things very Swiss.
Well, thank you for seeing us, and I know it's an incredibly busy day. Tonight the fireworks go off on the lake of St. Moritz, on the frozen lake, and if we look out the window just behind you, I can see that they're kind of setting up for tonight. You have an amazing hotel here. Could you just tell us how long it's been in your family and what makes this hotel so special for St. Moritz?
So the building, it's from 1885, so almost 135 years old, and I'm still here next year for 30 years. And the nicest view from every hotel from St. Moritz, just at the lake. And we make it from the hotel. It's a family three-star hotel, and we make it the largest whiskey bar in the world. So we have 2,500 different whiskies. And it's in a Guinness Book of Records. And then we have a very good, nice wine cellar with more than 1,200 different wines.
Tell me, how did this very now famous whiskey collection begin?
That was 25 years ago. I was in India. I brushed my teeth with whiskey because the bacteria in the water was not so very good. So I take the whiskey. And then I taste it, and then I brush my teeth, and after 1 week I say, oh, whiskey, it's very good. And so I start to collect whiskies.
And
I understand that recently Switzerland's even begun to make some of its own whiskies in the past, of course, you'd have imported them all from Scotland or Ireland or the United States, but now there are some Swiss ones as well, aren't there?
Yeah, we have from almost more than 20 countries. We have whiskey, but 90% from our single malt whiskey are from Scotland. But Switzerland make since 12 years our own whiskey. It's allowed since 12 years, and I had also boy dream to make some Samritzer whiskey, and I make the first Samritzer whiskey 10 years ago. So the next year comes the first bottling of Samritzer single malt.
This is a whiskey brand that you've set up yourself, and you're making it here in Samritz?
Right, we make it with bio barley and with Samritzer mountain water, so comes a very good single malt. If you come back next year, I'll let you try.
So you've had to wait 10 years to find out whether the experiment works. Have you been having, I presume you've been tasting it along the way. Are you hopeful this is going to be another great addition to the collection?
Right, yeah. You know, I think we can also make some Swiss whiskey. There are already about 30 people make Swiss whiskey. But they don't wait. I think, and I feel also, whiskey have to be minimum 10 years, 15, 20 years. But after 10 years, he smells like a whiskey.
And tell me, just even storing this vast collection. So the hotel for Alison is extraordinary because it's on a kind of little hill, isolated from the rest of the town, really in the most incredible position for overlooking all of the lake and the valley. But deep down beneath you then, do you have incredible cellars for storing all of this whiskey?
Yeah, we have also a whiskey shop. And you know, the name on this whiskey is the Real Highlander. The Real Highlander is because in Scotland you have the lowlands and the highlands. And the highest mountain, it's Ben Nevis with 1,300 meters. And we are here on 1,800 and goes up to 3,000 meters. So the Real Highlander single malt comes now from Samritz.
And tell me, do you have to explain to your guests that there's more to Glühwein at the end of the day then? Because I think when you go to around most of these hotels, that's what they give you when you come back off the slopes at the end of the day. But you, your customers, the people staying here at the hotel, you try to introduce them to the huge collection, I presume.
Sure. You know, it's much better to have a single malt, but a Glühwein. Glühwein, it's the most, we take this wine for cooking, but for drinking, you have to take a single malt.
And just tell me, the Samritz is a, you know, an extraordinary town because you have a huge amount of competition, lots of different kinds of hotels, and you have people from all around the world. What wins over customers in the end? You said you're a three-star hotel, so you're providing, you know, good quality accommodation. But like many of the hotels here, it's not always the rooms that seem to be the most important, especially for skiers. They're in and out of those rooms in no time. It's the food and the hospitality that matters. What do you try and add to that hospitality to make people come back again and again?
We have the most people that we have in the hotel come from Switzerland. So that's about 70%. 30% comes from United Kingdom, from Germany, from Italy, from everywhere. But 70% are Swiss, and the Swiss people like it not usually a five-star. You go in a three-star, maybe a small room, but the most nicest view from the room to the lake and the whiskey bar, then the friendly family atmosphere. Because we have only 100 beds, so it's a small hotel, and we like a family hotel, yeah.
And your son and daughter are following you in the business, I hear, as well.
Yeah, yeah. He started, he came back 1 year ago, and I'm very happy. So in the future, the Waldhaus goes well.
Well, I think you've very kindly given us something here on the table to conclude our little interview with. What's this on the table here?
So we have two single malt. I go everywhere to Scotland and buy the whole cask. And then we make a special bottling for the Waldhaus. So on the left side, you see it's a Bowmore with our label. And so I buy the whole cask, and then we make a special cask for which boat. That's a Bowmore. This came from the Isla. This is a very peaty one. And the second one, it's a Glenrothes. It was in a sherry cask, so it's more smoother. It's like sweetness because from the sherry cask. And you can also see the different color because this was in a sherry cask.
That will certainly warm you up after an afternoon on the slopes. Well, thank you very much for taking time out to show us your hotel and this amazing whiskey collection.
Thank you very much.
And that was Claudio Bernasconi talking to Andrew earlier today. You're listening to Midori House. It's 1925 here in St Moritz, and we're back in a moment for a bit of sailing. Now, St Moritz is often thought of as an ideal winter destination for skiing, skating, clasping a glass of blue wine, or just a promenade in the type of fur coats you simply couldn't get away with in Zurich or London. But there's just as much going on in the Engadina town in the summer months. The mountains here are good for hiking, and the city boasts a world-class jazz festival in August.
Another of the St Moritz summer attractions is the sailing match race, part of the Alpari World Match Race Tour, which has events from South Korea to Sweden, the United States to France. But the event here in St Moritz is a special one, more intimate than many others. It's a chance to get up close to some of the best sailors there are. Monocle's David Michon met up with Enrico De Maria, a member of the St Moritz Match Racing Organising Committee and a world champion sailor himself.
Ronald Pieper, my father-in-law, he started 10 years ago with the match racing in St Moritz. It started as a small event because, as you know, the Alinghi was sailing in New Zealand on the America's Cup. So there was UBS as a sponsor involved. And so he did a tour here in Switzerland. So that's how it all started with the match racing in Switzerland and particularly in St Moritz. And then as he passed away in 2007, my wife, she took over the business, basically. And so I got involved as well in the match racing here. So as a volunteer or just helping everywhere, and now as well for the last year and a half in the organizing committee.
Has there always been a really strong sailing tradition here in St Moritz, or did the match race really spark kind of a new, more invigorated interest in the sport?
The Vale of Engadine was always known at the lakes. Silva Plana was always known in the sailing community in Europe as a good lake because it's always, or almost always, steady winds in the summer. You have the Maloja wind, and it's quite nice to sail and surf as well. So there's a lot of kite surfers. And then the Lake of St Moritz is quite special because it's quite small, and it's a really unique spot to sail because you have a kind of an arena here. It's quite nice to see. You can walk around the lake, and we put up a grandstand where everybody can sit and watch the racing quite closely. So it's quite nice. And for some rates, it's quite nice having an event in the summer and sport event because, yeah, some rates is quite known in the winter. But in the summer, we have much racing, which is quite nice to watch as well.
Yeah, I actually wanted to ask you about that. You know, people think of it as a ski destination primarily, and, we always imagine it kind of covered in snow. But it does have a separate life in the summer. Can you just tell me about, what the city's like in the summer and what it's like to kind of come here and race if you're part of the match race?
Yeah, if you see now the lake frozen with all the snow, covered in snow, you cannot imagine how it would be in the summer. It's quite nice here as well, but to be honest, this year it snowed in August, September, so you should always have some gloves and some woolly hat ready to not to freeze. But in the summer, it's not that busy. But there's a Ferragosta in Italy, and it's a lot of Italian guests here as well. So it's quite interesting or quite busy as well. Not as busy as now, but it's always good crowd here, spectators as well.
And the sailors are put up in the Badritz Palace Hotel.
Yeah, the Palace Hotel is a sponsor of the event already for the last 10 years. And the sailors always appreciate and like to come here because obviously the Palace is a well-known and good address to stay in. And it's, as well, as I said before, a unique spot to sail because it's quite high altitude and, with all the mountains around and as well the snow, then it's quite unique and special for the sailors to sail here.
How does it compare to other stops on the Match Race or other places that you've sailed in particular? What makes Cimarex kind of an interesting place other than, you know, just as dramatic kind of vista?
Yeah, obviously it's not open sea here. We have a small lake and you have not like a current or strong waves, and it's a small area, small venue, and as well with the high altitude of Cimarex, the pressure is not the same as it is in the ocean, and so you have always, and as well it's quite shifty and tricky to sail because obviously it's a valley and there's a lot of wind shifts and a lot of pressure difference, so it's quite demanding for the sailors to sail here, and as well spectacular for the spectators because it's so close, you can just almost touch the boats when they set past.
And that was David Michon speaking to Enrico de Maria of the Cimarex Match Race.
Now, you may think that we've actually moved the show to Syria over the last few minutes, but no, we're still in Cimarex. That's not gunfire in the background. I think people are warming up for the firework display that's going to be happening at 2200 hours here in Cimarex. They delay their big fireworks to New Year's Day because, actually, on New Year's Eve, so many private houses and hotels have big displays. But that's all to come. There's lots of noise going on around us. There's people drinking, there's people carousing, and that's not just us. But anyway. Now, in the next half hour of the program, we'll be getting the second part of Sophie Grove's Spa series, and we'll meet the Romanche artist, Not Vital. But first, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Andrew, thanks very much. The US Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, is still receiving treatment at a New York hospital today after suffering a blood clot in a vein behind her right ear. Her doctor said that she's expected to make a full recovery. Elsewhere in the States, Joe Biden, the vice president, is meeting fellow Democrats in the U.S. House of Representatives in Washington to discuss the fiscal cliff deal that he helped forge with Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell. The deal raised some taxes on the wealthy while making permanent low tax rates on the middle classes. 10 men have today been found guilty by an Ethiopian court of plotting attacks against political and economic targets in the Horn of African country with the help of Islamist militants from neighboring Somalia. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez is in a stable condition and spent New Year's Eve with his daughters, according to the cancer-stricken leader's son-in-law, who also said in an appeal that supporters should ignore rumours about his health and his condition. And at least 60 people have been killed and around 200 more injured in a stampede during New Year's celebrations in the main city of the Ivory Coast, Abidjan. It's not clear what caused the stampede, which happened early this morning near a stadium where a fireworks display was being held. That's the latest news here from Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. This is Midori House on Monocle 24. We're coming to you live from the very bustling Cimarex.
Now, during our time here in Cimarex, our intrepid senior editor, Sophie Grove, has taken on the arduous task of surveying some of the Engadine's most sought-after spas for the benefits of our listeners, apparently. No jacuzzi has been left unwallowed in, no therapist left unquizzed. She's been sweating it out in steam rooms and saunas around the area.
And that's because, as we heard yesterday, the resort has been a wellness destination for decades. The Victorians came to the mountains to stomp around the sublime landscape and take the waters. And historians have even found a local Romanche water goddess that dates back hundreds of years. But for this edition of the Spa Guide, I made my way to the Culm Hotel, one of the resort's oldest, to try out its brand new spa and meet with the general manager in a couple's sauna suite. Here he is. So we're standing in a very beautiful spa suite, a treatment room, rather unusually with its own private quarters, a sauna and a steam room. Can you give us an insight into the design behind a room like this in the new spa?
This is our Culm Spa suite, containing of a steam room, a sauna, which can be a bio sauna or a regular sauna, Finnish sauna, and then with a jacuzzi, and this all is overlooking through a great large window the lake of Cimarex and the surrounding mountains. And the concept of a spa suite is basically to provide privacy for guests who do not want to share the sauna or steam room with other guests. And therefore, we have a wonderful suite here at our disposal, and where guests can really enjoy all the facilities, but in much, much privacy.
Now, the smell of the whole spa is incredible. There's this very fresh wood. Is that really part of the ambiance, but also the design behind the spa? It's very alpine.
Yeah, it is an alpine spa, and it reflects with the wood that has been used here, which is a local larch wood that basically has a very special perfume and has a very special scent. That wood is characteristic for the area of the Engadine and gives a lot of character to not only the spa suite, but the whole Combe Spa environment.
We've just walked past the beautiful pool, which is enormous and great for laps, I'd say, but also flooded with natural light. And this spa suite is too, a staggering view of the lake, but also flooded with natural light. We can see outside a outdoor pool. Is this idea of connected fresh air really central to what you're doing here?
Yes, of course, the air is a main factor here in the Engadine because we are so high up. The air is really, really pure. And through the altitude, we have very low temperatures during the night. It can go down to minus 10, minus 20 degrees Celsius. The days are sunny. Also, of course, a little bit warmer. And that creates a great balance of climate. And this, obviously, with an outdoor whirlpool, being able to enjoy the scenery, the panorama of the lake and the mountains, and being out in that fresh air and in warm water, that obviously is a fantastic experience, especially when afterwards, during the later afternoon, the sun goes down over the mountains and the mountains are covered with a special evening light.
And we should say that this is sort of a very holistic spa, but this is a ski resort and lots of people will be coming with aching limbs after a day on the slopes. Do you have a specific treatment for, you know, people who really want to get that sort of deep muscle relaxation after a day skiing?
Yes, we have various wraps that are fantastic for soothing the muscles after a full day of skiing. Or we have a sport massage for those people who like it a little bit, a stronger massage. Obviously, we also have the infrared cabin, which is very good to heal small muscle strains and basically restoring the body very quickly again.
And you're using aloe vera, you're using lots of natural products and Ericsson, you're also using some Swiss products. Can you give me an insight into really which your favourite products are here in the spa?
We have a product line that is called Alpien, which is based on all natural herbs that are grown here in the surrounding Alps. And basically there is a massage oil, there is a body wrap, and there are various oils also for soothing the skin. And those are very popular, and these treatments are very, very beneficial. And obviously the perfume of those herbs is fantastic. We also do a herb stamp massage with hot oil, which is very, very interesting and very relaxing for the body and the muscles.
And actually, I should compliment you on your own complexion. You've obviously been sparring for a very busy hotel manager. You're definitely looking good.
Thank you so much.
Well, that was Sophie Grove speaking to the general manager, Dominic Goddard, of the Combe Hotel here in St Moritz. And I must say, if you hadn't kind of sent yourself off to some rather tough assignments during the past year, I might have thought you were a spa guide person.
I know. I mean, really, I've just been on the, you know, dedicated this. No. I mean, senior editor, I've been to Mozambique, I've been to all these dear places, South Sudan, and I'm going to go and boil myself in a jacuzzi.
And do you know if they do a treatment to roll back, you know, kind of hours of eating cheese and Glühwein?
Hopefully. I mean, Mr. Goddard has got a great complexion. I just complimented him there, but he's clearly sort of, you know, quality control.
Okay, well, I think we need to book ourselves on for the de-cheesing one anyway. Thank you, Sophie. You're listening to a very special edition of Midori House. It's our last live programme from the terrace of the Hauser Hotel up here in Samaritz. Next up, we're going to have a little break, but then we're going to be joined by the artist Not Vital.
Montclair, keeping the slopes stylish and warm since 1952.
The latest culinary trends, restaurants with the best food, the coziest cafes and the makers behind them. The menu tells you all you need to know about the world of cuisine and drinks and the people who are doing things differently.
The end is very important, just as in a sad ending, you may feel sort of sad in a play. No, there's no such thing as a sad ending for a meal, but there is the idea of a resounding ending, like the coda of a last movement of a symphony.
From organic cuisine in Sao Paulo to the latest coffee trends in Helsinki, from the most adventurous speakeasy in New York to the best butchers in Sydney, tune in on Fridays at 1900 hours London time or download the shows from Monocle's website.
That's The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Krug.
Welcome back. You're listening to a special edition of Midori House live from the Hotel Hauser in St. Moritz.
Now, born in Sent, just an hour down the road from St. Moritz, Not Vital is an artist that works in painting, graphics and sculpture. Last year, he won a competition to have one of his sculptures sit outside Zurich's new Mobimo Tower. He currently has an exhibition entitled Five Spaniards and Nothing, presented by Ivory Press, his first solo show in Spain. And he joins us now. Welcome, Not, to the show.
Hi.
So tell us how, earlier in the week, we've been talking to a few galleries and different people in the art scene here in St. Moritz. Do you have a sense of a real heritage in terms of, you know, the modernist tradition?
Well, I think my work is actually based on the Engadine. You know, I was born here. I spent the first 14 years of my life. Speak Romance, and I think that I was able during those 14 years, my youth, to make a base, which was very solid, and also be able then to move on from there and. My work is very, in a way, it's based, I mean, it's very connected to the NGD.
And tell me, Not, one of the other things I know you do is you help run this foundation, which is to collect all the printed works in Romanche around the world and try and bring them back here to the Engadine Valley. Was that something that was done because, you know, you realized it inspired your work as well? Were the two very connected, your artwork and this foundation? Or was it because you actually, that's a different kind of part of your life, you just felt that you needed to help protect these books?
I have always been interested in books, in old books, and I've been collecting them since I'm quite young. And I thought that it would be great to have a complete collection of these Romanche books. And therefore I made this collection and this foundation in Erdetz, in a very beautiful town down the valley, which you should maybe come and see it. But it's my personal interest. And it's also interesting to see that if you see the first Romanche book was printed in 1560, and it was actually, you can still read it. Romanche has not changed. It has had not evolution, which is interesting. You can take a book from 1560, read it, and you understand everything. And I wanted to keep it together and make a foundation. This is one of my foundations. I have a few in the Engadine.
And in terms of Romanche as a sort of different perspective, really. We've had a Romansh singer and some people writing in Romansh, but I wondered how it informs you creatively. Is it a different sort of perspective on the world in a way, just in terms of being such a unique language?
Well, of course, I think you're always aware of it. You're always conscious about that, that you come from this extremely small minority of only 0.5% of the Swiss population. I think that we also want to add something to the language. I mean, when I was in high school, I translated Saint-Exupéry into Romansh. And it's something that, it's part of us. Can you understand? I mean, that even though I could only speak my mother language maybe 20% of my lifetime, it becomes very, very important to come back here and to and to get involved with this language. And of course, it has also, in some ways, probably also formed my artwork.
Tell me, the establishment of the foundation and this amazing library, is that a reflection of a kind of a growing Romansh pride? Are Romansh people kind of feeling a little bit more confident about themselves and their view of the world and what they represent in their traditions?
Do you mean by this foundation or in general?
I wonder, what's interesting is, that often in a country where a community is, as you say, only 0.5%, they can easily get kind of smothered by the other, here we're in a country where people very easily speak French and German and Italian, but Romansh is still a minority language. And I wondered whether actually that had always been a kind of outside the valleys, whether people recognise the importance of the Romansh culture, and whether the establishment of the foundation was an example of Romansh people saying, actually, we're doing lots of important things, we need to be a little bit more recognised.
Well, I think that we're actually quite recognised for being such a minority. I read someplace that, we're 36,000 people about, and we have 110 journalists. That's quite a lot, isn't it? So everyone adds something to the language. I did this, of course, for myself. I'm interested in books. I wanted to see this complete library, which I'm working on since many, many years. And it's not a missionary goal behind it. It's simply something I want to do.
And not, we talked about the very, very local. I'd like to touch on your own travels. You've been almost described as a nomad artist because you've worked in so many countries, including the USA, Switzerland, Chile, and Niger, for instance. Tell us about, particularly Niger, kind of untraveled country, really. How has that inspired your work, and what it's like sort of producing art there?
Well, first of all, it's not unusual, it's not atypical for someone from this valley to move. I mean, the village where I grew up in the Lower Engadine, Saint, already in 1600s, people moved. They moved south, they went to Italy, and they all pretty much did the same profession. They were pâtissiers, what you see right here, right? For me, it was very normal to move, to go. And of course, like being from here, you don't go to the sea. I was just now in Lamu 2 days ago. It's great, it's beautiful next to the sea, but for someone from the Engadine, it's just too hot and too humid and so on. So where I went was, of course, to the desert, which my first drawings, I remember, were from deserts and camels and so on. I went there, I was intrigued by living also with nomads or semi-nomads like the Tuaregs and the Pearls, and it was tremendously important to me in many ways. You can understand that growing up in Engadine, we only had to go to school for 7 months. We had 5 months off. April till October was off, okay? I remember going from the first class to the second, you went back to school, you could not read and write anymore. But during those times, you would do some very important, very passionate, we were building huts in the woods and so on, right? And later on, we lived actually in the woods. when I read later Italo Calvino, for example, it was nothing new to me. Been there, done that, right? So by going to Niger, I could re-enter that again. Something that I had done many, many years ago. First by building my own house. And what was very interesting is that everything went fast. It's amazing that Tuaregs who spend 4.5 hours every day drinking tea, their philosophy is what is fast is great, is good, right? So like when I got there at night, I decided that I wanted to live in this town, Agadez, knew very little about, maybe I saw a photograph, maybe I didn't even. I got there, in the morning I left the hotel, there were people outside, they've heard a white man has come to town, okay, let's try to sell him something. They're famous for jewelry, silver jewelry. They wanted to sell me silver jewelry. Said, well, I'm not that interested in silver jewelry. I would like to have, since I already made up my mind to come and live there, I would like a piece of land. They said, bad problem, no problem. They showed me this piece of land. It was maybe 8 o'clock. I liked it. 9 o'clock, the deal was made. 11 o'clock, the first people came and built the house. So this was actually very much what I did when I was young. And so he moved on, building a house to watch the sunset, have a house to watch the moon, against the heat and so on, and was actually now in Lamu, also invited by an English gallerist, great guy from Lisbon, to build a house to watch the sunset.
I must ask you one question before we wrap up in a minute. How did you get your name?
My name is very typical. Not is a common name in Lamont. It has been in the family since the 1400s. It was always Not Vital. And of course, it's strange. When I first went to the United States, I remember going to JFK, and they said, well, I mean, what is your name? I said, well, it's written there in the passport, isn't it? He says, yes, but I see 10,000 names every day. What is this? Your name is Not Vital? there were moments that I wanted to change. But like, once in New York, I walked down Broadway, I saw New York Times, the front page of New York Times, which said, nuclear plant called Not Vital, as a title. So I saw my name, right? So so this was, of course, cut off. My friends sent this article saying, congratulations. And there are many stories to my name. But it's a very common name. The names in Vermont are rather short. I think if my name would probably be not be Not, N-O-T, it could be Men, M-E-N. And not a long time ago, I saw this man whose name is Men. He came up to me and said, listen, your name in English means nothing, right? It's negative. So I said, well, you know what your name means? And he said, toilet. I said, toilet? Yeah, I saw it in a movie. It said Men, and that's where people went into to pee.
So you could have been a double barrel. You could have been Men Not Vital.
Could be.
That would be a very good romance name.
Or just B-U-T as a middle name.
Can you tell me, another thing that was interesting about being here in Engadina is, you know, that there's so much craft that goes on here. Now, a lot of the work you do is sculpture. Is there any kind of sense of the metalworking and the traditions of craft? You're obviously doing high art. You're doing something removed from the world of craft. But is there a chain of connection between, you know, what people used to do here in a craft tradition, kind of feeding into your artwork?
I think it was at one point. And it's we are also losing, like in any other place of Europe. That's why I had to move to China. My studio is now in Beijing. That's where the craft is done. Like, for example, chasing metal, which was done here at one point. People can no longer do that. At the beginning, it was very important to me. Yes, but people didn't.
So tell me, Knott's year is divided. How you're here in the Engadina during the winter, and then do you head off to China after this?
Oh, next week I'm going to Brazil. I'm here about 4 months in the summer, but also in between. Sometimes I only come here for 2 days. But usually the summers I spend here. I have a park outside of Saint with a house that disappears by remote control in the ground. So it's kind of like an interesting playground that I spend time in this place. And then of course I have to go work, and I go to Beijing, and I spend 2 months in my studio and don't even leave the place.
Well, Sophie was saying earlier on that some people think you're a nomad. I think you definitely are. So thank you so much for coming on. It's been amazing to hear about your perspective on the Engadina Valley and the world of romance and the world of art. Not Vidal, thank you very much for joining us on this very frosty terrace of the Hauser Hotel.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Uit London, dit is Monocle 24.
Fra London, dit is Monocle 24.
From London, desde Londres.
Holanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
Well, welcome back here. As I was saying, it's a very frosty terrace now here at the Hauser Hotel. The kind of cold air is pulling in, and actually some of the après-ski people have kind of vanished as well. But me and Sophie are still here. Sophie, you kind of came out here certainly a few days before me. It's been an amazing experience. This is our very last show. What were the highlights for you?
Oh, it's been amazing. Well, really, I loved sort of getting into the quirky sporting cultures here, apart from my spa extravaganzas, which I've hugely enjoyed. It's been amazing to look at the diversity. I mean, I'm now getting used to going into a restaurant speaking Italian and trotting across to a bar speaking German. It's just a wonderful diversity and wonderful hospitality, really.
I'd like to claim to be able to do that, but I don't speak either language. But anyway, I think what's also extraordinary is when you just set up tent like this in a little town, you just see the dynamics of how a town is run. We've met literally everybody from, you know, the hoteliers to the restaurant owners to the mayor. What a great guy just coming on talking about his art, his connection with the region.
It's incredibly diverse, and I feel like I know this town. I've been in every nook and cranny, and I've met the mayor, as you say. It's a huge privilege to sort of get to know somewhere so intimately and so thoroughly in such a short space of time.
Well, we're kind of packing up tonight, but we're going to stick everything in the garage up here, actually, because we're determined to come back in the summer and also again next year, because it has been an amazing way of meeting a kind of whole host of people and, as I said, understanding the dynamism of a town. One memory that you'll take away?
Well, I think probably, I don't know, my amazing hubble bubble over the incredible ice rink, and also being on the ice rink with you, Andrew Tuck, and David Michon. We had our editor-in-chief is definitely the best ice skater amongst us.
He literally ran circles around me.
He go backwards and do twirls.
It was something to see. Meanwhile, I was kind of like moving around like some old dinosaur.
You were fine. You weren't quite dancing on ice, but we were getting there.
No, the most humiliating thing is always is that some three-year-old who's kind of skating past you and kind of laughing as you kind of stumble into the snow. Well, anyway, I believe that's all we have time for today, and indeed here for the whole time in St Moritz. Thanks to our producer, David Michon, and we should also say a big thank you to Ala John, who was here earlier in the week, and our researcher, Manon Spindler. Jack Phillips was our studio manager here in Switzerland, with Alex Funnell manning the desk in London. And thanks also to Isabel Kaiser, back in London, for her very proficient and very Swiss, may I say, production coordination. Up next, after the news, is going to be Hugo McDonald with a special Best of 2012 edition of Section D. Tomorrow, it's back to London for everyone, with Ted Kravitz presenting the briefing at 12 noon London time from Studio One at Midori House. But for now, thanks for listening, and let's just say a very happy, happy new year to all of our listeners around the world. From me, Andrew Tuck.
Me, Sophie Grove.
Goodbye.